her family, and her medical team remained in battle mode. Within 24 hours, Sarah was brought in to see a radiation oncologist for whole brain radiation to try to reduce the metastases. On February 12th, she completed 5 days of radiation treatment, which left her immeasurably fatigued, barely able to get out of bed. She ate almost nothing. She weighed 25 pounds less than she had in the fall. She confessed to Rich that for the past 2 months, she had experienced double vision and was unable to feel her hands. "Why didn't you tell anyone?" he asked her. "I just didn't want to stop treatment," she said. "They would make me stop." She was given 2 weeks to recover her strength after the radiation. Then we had a different experimental drug she could try, one from a small biotech company. She was scheduled to start on February 25th. Her chances were rapidly dwindling, but who was to say they were zero? In 1985, the paleontologist and writer Stephen Jay Gould published an extraordinary essay entitled "The Median Isn't the Message," after he had been given a diagnosis 3 years earlier of abdominal mesothelioma, a rare and lethal cancer usually associated with asbestos exposure. He went to a medical library when he got the diagnosis and pulled out the latest scientific articles on the disease. The literature couldn't have been more brutally clear. Mesothelioma is incurable, with a median survival of only 8 months after discovery, he wrote. The news was devastating. But then he began looking at the graphs of the patient survival curves. Gould was a naturalist and more inclined to notice the variation around the curve's middle point than the middle point itself. What the naturalist saw was remarkable variation. The patients were not clustered around the median survival, but instead fanned out in both directions. Moreover, the curve was skewed to the right with a long tail, however slender, of patients who lived many years longer than the 8-month median. This is where he found solace. He could imagine himself surviving far out along that long tail. And survive he did. Following surgery and experimental chemotherapy, he lived 20 more years before dying in 2002 at the age of 60 from a lung cancer unrelated to his original disease. It has become, in my view, a bit too trendy to regard the acceptance of death as something tantamount to intrinsic dignity, he wrote in his 1985 essay. Of course, I agree with the preacher of Ecclesiastes that there is a time to love and a time to die, and when my skein runs out, I hope to face the end calmly and in my own way. For most situations, however, I prefer the more martial view that death is the ultimate enemy, and I find nothing reproachable in those who rage mightily against the dying of the light. I think of Gould and his essay every time I have a patient with a terminal illness. There is almost always a long tail of possibility, however thin. What's wrong with looking for it? Nothing, it seems to me, unless it means we have failed to prepare for the outcome that's vastly more probable. The trouble is that we've built our medical system and culture around the long tail. We've created a multi-trillion dollar edifice for dispensing the medical equivalent of lottery tickets, and have only the rudiments of a system to prepare patients for the near certainty that those tickets will not win. Hope is not a plan, but hope is our plan. For Sarah, there would be no miraculous recovery, and when the end approached, neither she nor her family was prepared. I always wanted to respect her request to die peacefully at home, Rich later told me, but I didn't believe we could make it happen. I didn't know how. On the morning of Friday, February 22nd, 3 days before she was to start her new round of chemo, Rich awoke to find his wife sitting upright beside him, pitched forward on her arms, eyes wide, struggling for air. She was gray, breathing fast, her body heaving with each open-mouthed gasp. She looked as if she were drowning. He tried turning up the oxygen in her nasal tubing, but she got no better. I can't do this, she said, pausing between each word. I'm scared. He had no emergency kit in the refrigerator, no hospice nurse to call. And how was he to know whether this new development was fixable? We'll go to the hospital, he told her. When he asked if they should drive, she shook her head, so he called 911 and told her mother Dawn, who was in the next room, what was going on. A few minutes later, firemen swarmed up the stairs to her bedroom, sirens wailing outside. As they lifted Sarah into the ambulance on a stretcher, Dawn came out in tears. We're going to get a hold of this, Rich told her. This was just another trip to the hospital, he said to himself. The doctors would figure out how to fix her. At the hospital, Sarah was diagnosed with pneumonia. That troubled the family because they thought they'd done everything to keep infection at bay. They'd washed hands scrupulously, limited visits by people with young children, even limited Sarah's time with baby Vivian if she showed the slightest sign of a runny nose. But Sarah's immune system and her ability to clear her lung secretions had been steadily weakened by the rounds of radiation and chemotherapy, as well as by the cancer. In another way, the diagnosis of pneumonia was reassuring because it was just an infection. It could be treated. The medical team started Sarah on intravenous antibiotics and high-flow oxygen through a mask. The family gathered at her bedside, hoping for the antibiotics to work. The problem could be reversible, they told one another. But that night and the next morning, her breathing only grew more labored. I can't think of a single funny thing to say, Emily told Sarah as their parents looked on. Neither can I, Sarah murmured. Only later did the family realize that those were the last words they would ever hear from her. After that, she began to drift in and out of consciousness. The medical team had only one option left, to put her on a ventilator. Sarah was a fighter, right? And the next step for fighters is to escalate to intensive care. This is a modern tragedy replayed millions of times over. When there is no way of knowing exactly how long our skeins will run, and when we imagine ourselves to have much more time than we do, our every impulse is to fight, to die with chemo in our veins, or a tube in our throats, or fresh sutures in our flesh. The fact that we may be shortening or worsening the time we have left hardly seems to register. We imagine that we can wait until the doctors tell us that there is nothing more they can do. But rarely is there nothing more that doctors can do. They can give toxic drugs of unknown efficacy, operate to try to remove part of the tumor, put in a feeding tube if a person can't eat. There's always something. We want these choices, but that doesn't mean we are eager to make the choices ourselves. Instead, most often, we make no choice at all. We fall back on the default, and the default is do something, fix something. Is there any way out of this? There's a school of thought that says the problem is the absence of market forces. If terminal patients, rather than insurance companies or the government, had to pay the added costs for the treatments they chose instead of hospice, they would take the trade-offs into account more. Terminal cancer patients wouldn't pay $80,000 for drugs, and end-stage heart failure patients wouldn't pay $50,000 for defibrillators offering at best a few months' extra survival. But this argument ignores an important factor. The people who opt for these treatments aren't thinking a few added months. They're thinking years. They're thinking they're getting at least that lottery ticket's chance that their disease might not even be a problem anymore. Moreover, if there's anything we want to buy in the free market or obtain from our government taxes, it is assurance that when we find ourselves in need of these options, we won't have to worry about the costs. This is why the R word, rationing, remains such a potent charge. There is broad unease with the circumstances we found ourselves in, but fear of discussing the specifics. For the only seeming alternative to a market solution is outright rationing, death panels, as some have charged. In the 1990s, insurance companies attempted to challenge the treatment decisions of doctors and patients in cases of terminal illness, but the attempts backfired, and one case in particular pretty much put an end to the strategy. The case of Nellene Fox. Fox was from Temecula, California, and was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer in 1991 when she was 38 years old. Surgery and conventional chemotherapy failed, and the cancer spread to her bone marrow. The disease was terminal. Doctors at the University of Southern California offered her a radical but seemingly promising new treatment, high-dose chemotherapy with bone marrow transplantation. To Fox, it was her one chance of cure. Her insurer, HealthNet, denied her request for coverage of the costs, arguing that it was an experimental treatment whose benefits were unproven and that it was therefore excluded under the terms of her policy. The insurer pressed her to get a second opinion from an independent medical center. Fox refused. Who were they to tell her to get another opinion? Her life was at stake. Raising $212,000 through charitable donations, she paid the costs of therapy herself. But it was delayed. She died 8 months after the treatment. Her husband sued HealthNet for bad faith, breach of contract, intentional infliction of emotional damage, and punitive damages, and won. The jury awarded her estate $89 million. The HMO executives were branded killers. 10 states enacted laws requiring insurers to pay for bone marrow transplantation for breast cancer. Never mind that HealthNet was right. Research ultimately showed the treatment to have no benefit for breast cancer patients and to actually worsen their lives. But the jury verdict shook the American insurance industry, raising questions about doctors and patients' treatment decisions in terminal illness was judged political suicide. In 2004, executives at another insurance company, Aetna, decided to try a different approach. Instead of reducing aggressive treatment options for their terminally ill policyholders, they decided to try increasing hospice options. Aetna had noted that only a minority of patients ever halted efforts at curative treatment and enrolled in hospice. Even when they did, it was usually not until the very end. So the company decided to experiment. Policyholders with a life expectancy of less than a year were allowed to receive hospice services without having to forgo other treatments. A patient like Sarah Monopoli could continue to try chemotherapy and radiation and go to the hospital when she wished, but she could also have a hospice team at home focusing on what she needed for the best possible life now and for that morning when she might wake up unable to breathe. A 2-year study of this concurrent care program found that enrolled patients were much more likely to use hospice. The figure leaped from 26% to 70%. That was no surprise, since they weren't forced to give up anything. The surprising results was that they did give up things. They visited the emergency room half as often as the control patients did. Their use of hospitals and ICUs dropped by more than 2/3. Overall costs fell by almost 1/4. The result was stunning and puzzling. It wasn't obvious what made the approach work. Aetna ran a more modest concurrent care program for a broader group of terminally ill patients. For these patients, the traditional hospice rules applied. In order to qualify for home hospice, they had to give up attempts at curative treatment. But either way, they received phone calls from palliative care nurses who offered to check in regularly and help them find services for anything from pain control to making out a living will. For these patients, too, hospice enrollment jumped to 70%, and their use of hospital services dropped sharply. Among elderly patients, use of intensive care units fell by more than 85%. Satisfaction scores went way up. What was going on here? The program's leaders had the impression that they had simply given seriously ill patients someone experienced and knowledgeable to talk to about their daily concerns. Somehow, that was enough. Just talking. The explanation would seem to strain credibility, but evidence for it has grown in recent years. 2/3 of the terminal cancer patients in the Coping with Cancer study reported having had no discussion with their doctors about their goals for end-of-life care, despite being, on average, just 4 months from death. But the third who did have discussions were far less likely to undergo cardiopulmonary resuscitation or be put on a ventilator or end up in an intensive care unit. Most of them enrolled in hospice. They suffered less, were physically more capable, and were better able for a longer period to interact with others. In addition, 6 months after these patients died, their family members were markedly less likely to experience persistent major depression. In other words, people who had substantive discussions with their doctor about their end-of-life preferences were far more likely to die at peace and in control of their situation and to spare their family anguish. A landmark 2010 study from the Massachusetts General Hospital had even more startling findings. The researchers randomly assigned 151 patients with stage 4 lung cancer, like Sarah's, to one of two possible approaches to treatment. Half received usual oncology care. The other half received usual oncology care plus parallel visits with a palliative care specialist. These are specialists in preventing and relieving the suffering of patients, and to see one, no determination of whether they are dying or not is required. If a person has serious, complex illness, palliative specialists are happy to help. The ones in the study discussed with the patients their goals and priorities for if and when their condition worsened. The result? Those who saw a palliative care specialist stopped chemotherapy sooner, entered hospice far earlier, experienced less suffering at the end of their lives, and they lived 25% longer. In other words, our decision-making in medicine has failed so spectacularly that we have reached the point of actively inflicting harm on patients rather than confronting the subject of mortality. If end-of-life discussions were an experimental drug, the FDA would approve it. Patients entering hospice have had no less surprising results. Like many other people, I had believed that hospice care hastens death, because patients forgo hospital treatments and are allowed high-dose narcotics to combat pain. But multiple studies find otherwise. In one, researchers followed 4,493 Medicare patients with either terminal cancer or end-stage congestive heart failure. For the patients with breast cancer, prostate cancer, or colon cancer, the researchers found no difference in survival time between those who went into hospice and those who didn't. And curiously, for some conditions, hospice care seemed to extend survival. Those with pancreatic cancer gained an average of 3 weeks. Those with lung cancer gained 6 weeks, and those with congestive heart failure gained 3 months. The lesson seems almost zen. You live longer only when you stop trying to live longer. Can mere discussions achieve such effects? Consider the case of La Crosse, Wisconsin. Its elderly residents have unusually low end-of-life hospital costs. During their last 6 months, according to Medicare data, they spend half as many days in the hospital as the national average, and there's no sign that doctors or patients are halting care prematurely. Despite average rates of obesity and smoking, their life expectancy outpaces the national mean by a year. I spoke to Gregory Thompson, a critical care specialist at Gundersen Lutheran Hospital, while he was on ICU duty one evening, and he ran through his list of patients with me. In most respects, the patients were like those found in any ICU, terribly sick and living through the most perilous days of their lives. There was a young woman with multiple organ failure from a devastating case of pneumonia, a man in his mid-60s with a ruptured colon that had caused a rampaging infection and a heart attack. Yet these patients were completely different from those in the ICUs I'd worked in. None had a terminal disease. None battled the final stages of metastatic cancer or untreatable heart failure or dementia. To understand lacrosse, Thompson said, you had to go back to 1991 when local medical leaders headed a systematic campaign to get medical people and patients to discuss end-of-life wishes. Within a few years, it became routine for all patients admitted to a hospital, nursing home, or assisted living facility to sit down with someone experienced in these conversations and complete a multiple-choice form that boiled down to four crucial questions. At this moment in your life, the form asked, 1. Do you want to be resuscitated if your heart stops? 2. Do you want aggressive treatments such as intubation and mechanical ventilation? 3. Do you want antibiotics? 4. Do you want tube or intravenous feeding if you can't eat on your own? By 1996, 85% of lacrosse residents who died had a written advanced directive like this, up from 15%, and doctors virtually always knew of the instructions and followed them. Having this system in place, Thompson said, has made his job vastly easier. But it's not because the specifics are spelled out for him every time a sick patient arrives in his unit. These things are not laid out in stone, he told me. Whatever the yes-no answers people may put on a piece of paper, one will find nuances and complexities in what they mean. But instead of having the discussion when they get to the ICU, we find many times it has already taken place. Answers to the list of questions change as patients go from entering the hospital for the delivery of a child to entering for the complications of Alzheimer's disease. But in lacrosse, the system means that people are far more likely to have talked about what they want and what they don't want before they and their relatives find themselves in the throes of crisis and fear. When wishes aren't clear, Thompson said, families have also become much more receptive to having the discussion. The discussion, not the list, was what mattered most. Discussion had brought lacrosse's end-of-life costs down to half the national average. It was that simple and that complicated. One winter Saturday morning, I met with a woman I had operated on the night before. She had been undergoing a procedure for the removal of an ovarian cyst when the gynecologist who was operating on her discovered that she had metastatic colon cancer. I was summoned as a general surgeon to see what could be done. I removed a section of her colon that had a large cancerous mass, but the cancer had already spread widely. I had not been able to get it all. Now I introduced myself. She said a resident had told her that a tumor was found and part of her colon had been excised. Yes, I said. I'd been able to take out the main area of involvement. I explained how much bowel was removed, what the recovery would be like, everything except how much cancer there was. But then I remembered how timid I'd been with Sarah Monopoly and all those studies about how much doctors beat around the bush. So when she asked me to tell her more about the cancer, I explained that it had spread not only to her ovaries, but also to her lymph nodes. I said that it had not been possible to remove all the disease. But I found myself almost immediately minimizing what I'd said. We'll bring in an oncologist, I hastened to add. Chemotherapy can be very effective in these situations. She absorbed the news in silence, looking down at the blankets drawn over her mutinous body. Then she looked up at me. Am I going to die? I flinched. No, no, I said. Of course not. A few days later, I tried again. We don't have a cure, I explained, but treatment can hold the disease down for a long time. The goal, I said, was to prolong your life as much as possible. I have followed her in the months and years since as she embarked on chemotherapy. She has done well. So far, the cancer is in check. Once, I asked her and her husband about our initial conversations. They didn't remember them very fondly. That one phrase that you used, prolong your life, it just... She didn't want to sound critical. It was kind of blunt, her husband said. It sounded harsh, she echoed. She felt as if I'd dropped her off a cliff. I spoke to Susan Block, a palliative care specialist at my hospital, who has had thousands of these difficult conversations and is a nationally recognized pioneer in training doctors and others in managing end-of-life issues with patients and their families. "You have to understand," Block told me, "a family meeting is a procedure, and it requires no less skill than performing an operation. One basic mistake is conceptual. To most doctors, the primary purpose of a discussion about terminal illness is to determine what people want, whether they want chemo or not, whether they want to be resuscitated or not, whether they want hospice or not. We focus on laying out the facts and the options, but that's a mistake," Block said. "A large part of the task is helping people negotiate the overwhelming anxiety, anxiety about death, anxiety about suffering, anxiety about loved ones, anxiety about finances," she explained. "There are many worries and real terrors. No one conversation can address them all. Arriving at an acceptance of one's mortality and a clear understanding of the limits and the possibilities of medicine is a process, not an epiphany. There is no single way to take people with terminal illness through the process, but there are some rules, according to Block. You sit down. You make time. You're not determining whether they want treatment X versus Y. You're trying to learn what's most important to them under the circumstances so that you can provide information and advice on the approach that gives them their best chance of achieving it. This process requires as much listening as talking. If you are talking more than half of the time, Block says, you're talking too much. The words you use matter. According to palliative specialists, you shouldn't say, I'm sorry things turned out this way, for example. It can sound like you're distancing yourself. You should say, I wish things were different. You don't ask, what do you want when you are dying? You ask, if time becomes short, what is most important to you? Block has a list of questions that she aims to cover with sick patients in the time before decisions have to be made. What do they understand their prognosis to be? What are their concerns about what lies ahead? What kinds of trade-offs are they willing to make? How do they want to spend their time if their health worsens? Who do they want to make decisions if they can't? A decade earlier, her 74-year-old father, Jack Block, a professor emeritus of psychology at the University of California at Berkeley, was admitted to a San Francisco hospital with symptoms from what proved to be a mass growing in the spinal cord of his neck. She flew out to see him. The neurosurgeon said that the procedure to remove the mass carried a 20% chance of leaving him quadriplegic, paralyzed from the neck down. But without it, he had a 100% chance of becoming quadriplegic. The evening before surgery, father and daughter chatted about friends and family, trying to keep their minds off what was to come, and then she left for the night. Halfway across the Bay Bridge, she recalled, I realized, oh my God, I don't know what he really wants. He'd made her his healthcare proxy, but they had talked about such situations only superficially, so she turned the car around. Going back in was really uncomfortable, she said. It made no difference that she was an expert in end-of-life discussions. I just felt awful having the conversation with my dad, but she went through her list. She told him, I need to understand how much you're willing to go through to have a shot at being alive, and what level of being alive is tolerable to you. We had this quite agonizing conversation where he said, and this totally shocked me, well, if I'm able to eat chocolate ice cream and watch football on TV, then I'm willing to stay alive. I'm willing to go through a lot of pain if I have a shot at that. I would never have expected him to say that, Block said. I mean, he's a professor emeritus. He's never watched a football game in my conscious memory. The whole picture, it wasn't the guy I thought I knew. But the conversation proved critical, because after surgery, he developed bleeding in the spinal cord. The surgeons told her that in order to save his life, they would need to go back in. But the bleeding had already made him nearly quadriplegic, and he would remain severely disabled for many months and likely forever. What did she want to do? I had 3 minutes to make this decision, and I realized he had already made the decision. She asked the surgeons whether if her father survived, he would be able to eat chocolate ice cream and watch football on TV. Yes, they said. She gave the okay to take him back to the operating room. If I had not had that conversation with him, she told me, my instinct would have been to let him go at that moment because it just seemed so awful, and I would have beaten myself up. Did I let him go too soon? Or she might have gone ahead and sent him to surgery, only to find, as occurred, that he was faced with a year of very horrible rehab and disability. I would have felt so guilty that I condemned him to that, she said. But there was no decision for me to make. He had decided. During the next 2 years, he regained the ability to walk short distances. He required caregivers to bathe and dress him. He had difficulty swallowing and eating, but his mind was intact, and he had partial use of his hands, enough to write 2 books and more than a dozen scientific articles. He lived for 10 years after the operation. Eventually, however, his difficulties with swallowing advanced to the point where he could not eat without aspirating food particles, and he cycled between hospital and rehabilitation facilities with the pneumonias that resulted. He didn't want a feeding tube, and it became evident that the battle for the dwindling chance of a miraculous recovery was going to leave him unable ever to go home again. So just a few months before I'd spoken with Block, her father decided to stop the battle and go home. We started him on hospice care, Block said. We treated his choking and kept him comfortable. Eventually, he stopped eating and drinking. He died about 5 days later. Susan Block and her father had the conversation that we all need to have when the chemotherapy stops working, when we start needing oxygen at home, when we face high-risk surgery, when the liver failure keeps progressing, when we become unable to dress ourselves. I've heard Swedish doctors call it a breakpoint discussion, a series of conversations to sort out when they need to switch from fighting for time to fighting for the other things that people value. Being with family, or traveling, or enjoying chocolate ice cream. Few people have these conversations, and there is good reason for anyone to dread them. They can unleash difficult emotions. People can become angry or overwhelmed. Handled poorly, the conversations can cost a person's trust. Handled well, they can take real time. I spoke to an oncologist who told me about a 29-year-old patient she had recently cared for who had an inoperable brain tumor that continued to grow through second-line chemotherapy. The patient elected not to attempt any further chemotherapy, but getting to that decision required hours of discussion, for this was not the decision he had expected to make. First, the oncologist said, she had a discussion with him alone. They reviewed the story of how far he'd come, the options that remained. She was frank. She told him that in her entire career she had never seen third-line chemotherapy produce a significant response in his type of brain tumor. She had looked for experimental therapies, and none were truly promising. And although she was willing to proceed with chemotherapy, she told him how much strength and time the treatment would take away from him and his family. He did not shut down or rebel. His questions went on for an hour. He asked about this therapy and that therapy. Gradually, he began to ask what would happen as the tumor got bigger, what symptoms he'd have, what ways they could try to control them, how the end might come. The oncologist next met with the young man together with his family. That discussion didn't go so well. He had a wife and small children, and at first, his wife wasn't ready to contemplate stopping chemo. But when the oncologist asked the patient to explain in his own words what they'd discussed, she understood. It was the same with his mother, who was a nurse. Meanwhile, his father sat quietly and said nothing the entire time. A few days later, the patient returned to talk to the oncologist. "There should be something. There must be something," he said. His father had shown him reports of cures on the internet. He confided how badly his father was taking the news. No patient wants to cause his family pain. According to Block, about 2/3 of patients are willing to undergo therapies they don't want if that is what their loved ones want. The oncologist went to the father's home to meet with him. He had a sheaf of possible trials and treatments printed from the internet. She went through them all. She was willing to change her opinion, she told him, but either the treatments were for brain tumors that were very different from his son's, or else he didn't qualify. None were going to be miraculous. She told the father that he needed to understand. Time with his son was limited, and the young man was going to need his father's help getting through it. The oncologist noted wryly how much easier it would have been for her just to prescribe chemotherapy. But that meeting with the father was the turning point, she said. The patient and the family opted for hospice. They had more than a month together before he died. Later, the father thanked the doctor. That last month, he said, the family simply focused on being together, and it proved to be the most meaningful time they'd ever spent. Given how prolonged some of these conversations have to be, many people argue that the key problem has been the financial incentives. We pay doctors to give chemotherapy and to do surgery, but not to take the time required to sort out when to do so is unwise. This certainly is a factor, but the issue isn't merely a matter of financing. It arises from a still unresolved argument about what the function of medicine really is. What, in other words, we should and should not be paying for doctors to do. The simple view is that medicine exists to fight death and disease, and that is, of course, its most basic task. Death is the enemy. But the enemy has superior forces. Eventually, it wins. And in a war that you cannot win, you don't want a general who fights to the point of total annihilation. You don't want Custer. You want Robert E. Lee. Someone who knows how to fight for territory that can be won and how to surrender it when it can't. Someone who understands that the damage is greatest if all you do is battle to the bitter end. More often these days, medicine seems to supply neither Custer's nor Lee's. We are increasingly the generals who march the soldiers onward, saying all the while, "You let me know when you want to stop." All-out treatment, we tell the incurably ill, is a train you can get off at any time, just say when. But for most patients and their families, we are asking too much. They remain riven by doubt and fear and desperation. Some are deluded by a fantasy of what medical science can achieve. Our responsibility in medicine is to deal with human beings as they are. People die only once. They have no experience to draw on. They need doctors and nurses who are willing to have the hard discussions and say what they have seen, who will help people prepare for what is to come and escape a warehoused oblivion that few really want. Sarah Monopoli had had enough discussions to let her family and her oncologist know that she did not want hospitals or ICUs at the end, but not enough to have learned how to achieve her goal. From the moment she arrived in the emergency room that Friday morning in February, the train of events ran against a peaceful ending. There was one person who was disturbed by this, though, and who finally decided to intercede. Chuck Morris, her primary care physician. As her illness had progressed through the previous year, he had left the decision-making largely to Sarah, her family, and the oncology team. Still, he had seen her and her husband regularly and listened to their concerns. That desperate morning, Morris was the one person Rich called before getting into the ambulance. He headed to the emergency room and met Sarah and Rich when they arrived. Morris said that the pneumonia might be treatable, but he told Rich, "I'm worried this is it. I'm really worried about her." And he told him to let the family know that he said so. Upstairs in her hospital room, Morris talked with Sarah and Rich about the ways in which the cancer had been weakening her, making it hard for her body to fight off infection. Even if the antibiotics halted the infection, he said, he wanted them to remember that there was nothing that would stop the cancer. Sarah looked ghastly, Morris told me. She was so short of breath. It was uncomfortable to watch. I still remember the attending, the covering oncologist who admitted her for the pneumonia treatment. He was actually kind of rattled about the whole case, and for him to be rattled is saying something. After her parents arrived, Morris talked with them too, and when they were finished, Sarah and her family agreed on a plan. The medical team would continue the antibiotics, but if things got worse, they would not put her on a breathing machine. They also let him call the palliative care team to visit. The team prescribed a small dose of morphine, which immediately eased her breathing. Her family saw how much her suffering diminished, and suddenly they didn't want any more suffering. The next morning, they were the ones to hold back the medical team. They wanted to put a catheter in her, do this other stuff to her, her mother Dawn told me. I said, no, you aren't going to do anything to her. I didn't care if she wet her bed. They wanted to do lab tests, blood pressure measurements, finger sticks. I was very uninterested in their bookkeeping. I went over to see the head nurse and told them to stop. In the previous 3 months, almost nothing we'd done to Sarah, none of the scans or tests or radiation or extra rounds of chemotherapy, had likely achieved anything except to make her worse. She may well have lived longer without any of it. At least she was spared at the very end. That day, Sarah fell into unconsciousness as her body continued to fail. Through the next night, Rich recalled, there was this awful groaning. There is no prettifying death. Whether it was with inhaling or exhaling, I don't remember, but it was horrible, horrible, horrible to listen to. Her father and her sister still thought she might rally. But when the others had stepped out of the room, Rich knelt down weeping beside Sarah and whispered in her ear, "It's okay to let go," he said. "You don't have to fight anymore. I will see you soon." Later that morning, her breathing changed, slowing. Rich said, "Sarah just kind of startled. She let a long breath out. Then she just stopped." 7. Hard Conversations. Traveling abroad sometime afterward, I fell into a conversation with two doctors from Uganda and a writer from South Africa. I told them about Sarah's case and asked what they thought should have been done for her. To their eyes, the choices we offered her seemed extravagant. Most people with terminal illness in their countries would never have come to the hospital, they said. Those who did would neither expect nor tolerate the extremes of multiple chemotherapy regimens, last-ditch surgical procedures, experimental therapies, when the problem's ultimate outcome was so dismally clear, and the health system wouldn't have the money for it. But then they couldn't help but talk about their own experiences, and their tales sounded familiar. A grandparent put on life support against his wishes, a relative with incurable liver cancer who died in the hospital on an experimental treatment, a brother-in-law with a terminal brain tumor who nonetheless endured endless cycles of chemotherapy that had no effect except to cut him down further and further. Each round was more horrible than the last, the South African writer told me. I saw the medicine eat his flesh. The children are still traumatized. He could never let go. Their countries were changing. 5 of the 10 fastest-growing economies in the world are in Africa. By 2030, 1/2 to 2/3 of the global population will be middle class. Vast numbers of people are becoming able to afford consumer goods like televisions and cars, and health care. Surveys in some African cities are finding, for example, that 1/2 of the elderly over 80 years old now die in the hospital, and even higher percentages of those less than 80 years old do. These are numbers that actually exceed those in most developed countries today. Versions of Sarah's story are becoming global. As incomes rise, private sector healthcare is increasing rapidly, usually paid for in cash. doctors everywhere become all too ready to offer false hopes, leading families to empty bank accounts, sell their seed crops, and take money from their children's education for futile treatments. Yet at the same time, hospice programs are appearing everywhere from Kampala to Kinshasa, Lagos to Lesotho, not to mention Mumbai to Manila. Scholars have posited three stages of medical development that countries go through, paralleling their economic development. In the first stage, when a country is in extreme poverty, most deaths occur in the home because people don't have access to professional diagnosis and treatment. In the second stage, when a country's economy develops and its people transition to higher income levels, the greater resources make medical capabilities more widely available. People turn to healthcare systems when they are ill. At the end of life, they often die in the hospital instead of the home. In the third stage, as a country's income climbs to the highest levels, people have the means to become concerned about the quality of their lives, even in sickness, and deaths at home actually rise again. This pattern seems to be what is happening in the United States. Whereas deaths in the home went from a clear majority in 1945 to just 17% in the late 80s, since the 90s, the numbers have reversed direction. Use of hospice care has been growing steadily, to the point that by 2010, 45% of Americans died in hospice. More than half of them received hospice care at home, and the remainder received it in an institution, usually an inpatient hospice facility for the dying, or a nursing home. These are among the highest rates in the world. A monumental transformation is occurring. In this country and across the globe, people increasingly have an alternative to withering in old age homes and dying in hospitals, and millions of them are seizing the opportunity. But this is an unsettled time. We've begun rejecting the institutionalized version of aging and death, but we've not yet established our new norm. We're caught in a transitional phase. However miserable the old system has been, we are all experts at it. We know the dance moves. You agree to become a patient, and I, the clinician, agree to try to fix you, whatever the improbability, the misery, the damage, or the cost. With this new way in which we together try to figure out how to face mortality and preserve the fiber of a meaningful life with its loyalties and individuality, we are plodding novices. We are going through a societal learning curve, one person at a time. And that would include me, whether as a doctor or as simply a human being. My father was in his early 70s when I was forced to realize that he might not be immortal. He'd been as healthy as a Brahma bull, playing tennis 3 days a week, maintaining a busy urology practice, and serving as president of the local Rotary Club. He had tremendous energy. He did numerous charity projects, including working with a rural Indian college he'd established, expanding it from a single building to a campus with some 2,000 students. Whenever I came home, I'd bring my tennis rackets and we'd go out on the local courts. He played to win, and so did I. He'd drop shot me. I'd drop shot him. He'd lob me. I'd lob him. He had picked up a few old man habits, like blowing his nose onto the court whenever he felt like it, or making me chase down our errant tennis balls. But I took them to be the kinds of advantages a father takes with a son, rather than signs of age. In more than 30 years of medical practice, he'd not canceled his clinic or operating schedule for sickness once. So when he mentioned the development of a neck pain that shot down his left arm and caused tingling in the tips of his left fingers, neither one of us was inclined to think too much of it. An X-ray of his neck showed only arthritis. He took anti-inflammatory medication, underwent physical therapy, and took a break from using an overhead serve, which exacerbated the pain. Otherwise, it was life as usual for him. Over the next couple years, however, the neck pain progressed. It became difficult for him to sleep comfortably. The tingling in the tips of his left fingers became full-blown numbness and spread to his whole left hand. He found he had trouble feeling the thread when tying sutures during vasectomies. In the spring of 2006, His doctor ordered an MRI of his neck. The findings were a complete shock. The scan revealed a tumor growing inside his spinal cord. That was the moment when we stepped through the looking glass. Nothing about my father's life and expectations for it would remain the same. Our family was embarking on its own confrontation with the reality of mortality. The test for us as parents and children would be whether we could make the path go any differently for my dad than I, as a doctor, had made it go for my patients. The number two pencils had been handed out. The timer had been started. But we had not even registered that the test had begun. My father sent me the images by email, and we spoke by phone as we looked at them on our laptops. The mass was nauseating to behold. It filled the entire spinal canal, extending all the way up to the base of his brain and down to the level of his shoulder blades. It appeared to be obliterating his spinal cord. I was amazed that he wasn't paralyzed, that all the thing had done so far was make his hand numb and his neck hurt. We didn't talk about any of this, though. We had trouble finding anywhere safe for conversation to take purchase. I asked him what the radiologist's report said the mass might be. Various benign and malignant tumors were listed, he said. Did it suggest any other possibilities besides a tumor? Not really, he said. Two surgeons, we puzzled over how a tumor like this could be removed. But there seemed no way, and we grew silent. Let's talk to a neurosurgeon before jumping to any conclusions, I said. Spinal cord tumors are rare, and few neurosurgeons have much experience with them. A dozen cases is a lot. Among the most experienced neurosurgeons was one at the Cleveland Clinic, which was 200 miles from my parents' home, and one at my hospital in Boston. We made appointments at both places. Both surgeons offered surgery. They would open up the spinal cord, I didn't even know that was possible, and remove as much of the tumor as they could. They'd only be able to remove part of it, though. The tumor's primary source of damage was from its growth inside the confined space of the spinal canal. The beast was outgrowing its cage. The expansion of the mass was crushing the spinal cord against the vertebral bone, causing pain as well as destruction of the nerve fibers that make up the cord. So both surgeons proposed also doing a procedure to expand the space for the tumor to grow. They'd decompress the tumor by opening the back of the spinal column and stabilize the vertebra with rods. It'd be like taking the back wall off a tall building and replacing it with columns to hold up the floors. The neurosurgeon at my hospital advocated operating right away. The situation was dangerous, he told my father. He could become quadriplegic in weeks. No other options existed. Chemotherapy and radiation were not nearly as effective in stopping progression as surgery. The operation had risks, he said, but he wasn't too worried about them. He was more concerned about the tumor. My father needed to act before it was too late. The neurosurgeon at the Cleveland Clinic painted a more ambiguous picture. While he offered the same operation, he didn't push to do it right away. He said that while some spinal cord tumors advanced rapidly, he'd seen many take years to progress, and they did so in stages, not all at once. He didn't think my father would go from a numb hand to total paralysis overnight. The question, therefore, was when to go in, and he believed that should be when the situation became intolerable enough for my father to want to attempt treatment. The surgeon was not as blithe about its risks as the other neurosurgeon. He thought it carried a 1 in 4 chance of itself causing quadriplegia or death. My father, he said, would need to draw a line in the sand. Were his symptoms already bad enough that he wanted surgery now? Would he want to wait until he started to feel hand symptoms that threatened his ability to do surgery? Would he want to wait until he couldn't walk? The information was difficult to take in. How many times had my father given patients bad news like this, that they had prostate cancer, for instance, requiring similarly awful choices to be made? How many times had I done the same? The news, nonetheless, came like a body blow. Neither surgeon came out and said that the tumor was fatal, but neither said the tumor could be removed either. It could only be decompressed. In theory, a person should make decisions about life and death matters analytically, on the basis of the facts. But the facts were shot through with holes and uncertainties. The tumor was rare. No clear predictions could be made. Making choices required somehow filling the gaps, and what my father filled them with was fear. He feared the tumor and what it would do to him, and he also feared the solution being proposed. He could not fathom opening up the spinal cord, and he found it difficult to put his trust in any operation that he did not understand, that he did not feel capable of doing himself. He asked the surgeons numerous questions about how exactly it would be done. "What kind of instrument do you use to enter the spinal cord?" he asked. "Do you use a microscope? How do you cut through the tumor? How do you cauterize the blood vessels? Couldn't the cautery damage the nerve fibers of the cord?" "We use such and such an instrument to control prostate bleeding in urology. Wouldn't it be better to use that?" "Why not?" The neurosurgeon at my hospital didn't much like my father's questions. He was fine answering the first couple, but after that he grew exasperated. He had the air of the renowned professor he was, authoritative, self-certain, and busy with things to do. "Look," he said to my father, "the tumor was dangerous. He, the neurosurgeon, had a lot of experience treating such tumors. Indeed, no one had more. The decision for my father was whether he wanted to do something about his tumor. If he did, the neurosurgeon was willing to help. If he didn't, that was his choice." When the doctor finished, my father didn't ask any more questions, but he'd also decided that this man wasn't going to be his surgeon. The Cleveland Clinic neurosurgeon, Edward Benzel, exuded no less confidence, but he recognized that my father's questions came from fear. So he took the time to answer them, even the annoying ones. Along the way, he probed my father, too. He said that it sounded like he was more worried about what the operation might do to him than what the tumor would. My father said he was right. My father didn't want to risk losing his ability to practice surgery for the sake of treatment of uncertain benefit. The surgeon said that he might feel the same way himself in my father's shoes. Benzel had a way of looking at people that let them know he was really looking at them. He was several inches taller than my parents, but he made sure to sit at eye level. He turned his seat away from the computer and planted himself directly in front of them. He did not twitch or fidget or even react when my father talked. He had that Midwesterner's habit of waiting a beat after people have spoken before speaking himself in order to see if they are really done. He had small dark eyes set behind wire-rimmed glasses and a mouth hidden by the thick gray bristle of a Van Dyke beard. The only thing to hint at what he was thinking was the wrinkle of his glossy dome of a forehead. Eventually, he steered the conversation back to the central issue. The tumor was worrisome, but he now understood something about my father's concerns. He believed my father had time to wait and see how quickly his symptoms changed. He could hold off surgery until he felt he needed it. My father decided to go with Benzel and his counsel. My parents made a plan to return in a few months for a checkup and to call sooner if he experienced any signs of serious change. Did he prefer Benzel simply because he'd portrayed a better, at least slightly less alarming, picture of what might happen with the tumor? Maybe. It happens. Patients tend to be optimists, even if that makes them prefer doctors who are more likely to be wrong. Only time would tell which of the two surgeons was right. Nonetheless, Benzel had made the effort to understand what my father cared about most, and to my father, that counted for a lot. Even before the visit was halfway over, he had decided Benzel was the one he would trust. In the end, Benzel was also the one who proved right. As time passed, my father noticed no change in symptoms. He decided to put off the follow-up appointment. It was ultimately a year before he returned to see Benzel. A repeat MRI showed the tumor had enlarged, yet physical examination found no diminishment in my dad's strength, sensation, or mobility, so they decided to go primarily by how he felt, not by what the pictures looked like. The MRI reports would say haunting things, like the imaging demonstrates significant increase in size of the cervical mass at the level of the medulla and midbrain. But for months at a stretch, nothing occurred to change anything relevant for how he lived. The neck pain remained annoying, but my father figured out the best positions for sleeping at night. When chilly weather came, he found that his numb left hand became bone cold. He took to wearing a glove over it, Michael Jackson style, even indoors at home. Otherwise, he kept on driving, playing tennis, doing surgery, living life as he had been. He and his neurosurgeon knew what was coming, but they also knew what mattered to him and left well enough alone. This was, I remember thinking, just the way I ought to make decisions with my own patients, the way we all ought to in medicine. During medical school, my fellow classmates and I were assigned to read a short paper by two medical ethicists, Ezekiel and Linda Emanuel, on the different kinds of relationships that we, as budding new clinicians, might have with our patients. The oldest, most traditional kind is a paternalistic relationship. We are medical authorities aiming to ensure that patients receive what we believe best for them. We have the knowledge and experience. We make the critical choices. If there were a red pill and a blue pill, we would tell you, take the red pill. It will be good for you. We might tell you about the blue pill, but then again, we might not. We tell you only what we believe you need to know. It is the priestly, doctor-knows-best model, and although often denounced, it remains a common mode, especially with vulnerable patients, the frail, the poor, the elderly, and anyone else who tends to do what they're told. The second type of relationship the authors termed informative. It's the opposite of the paternalistic relationship. We tell you the facts and figures, the rest is up to you. Here's what the red pill does, and here's what the blue pill does, we would say. Which one do you want? It's a retail relationship. The doctor is the technical expert. The patient is the consumer. The job of doctors is to supply up-to-date knowledge and skills. The job of patients is to supply the decisions. This is the increasingly common way for doctors to be, and it tends to drive us to become ever more specialized. We know less and less about our patients, but more and more about our science. Overall, this kind of relationship can work beautifully, especially when the choices are clear, the trade-offs are straightforward, and people have clear preferences. You get only the tests, the pills, the operations, the risks that you want and accept. You have complete autonomy. The neurosurgeon at my hospital in Boston showed elements of both these types of roles. He was the paternalistic doctor. Surgery was my father's best choice, he insisted, and my father needed to have it now. But my father pushed him to try to be the informative doctor, to go over the details and the options. So the surgeon switched. But the descriptions only increased my father's fears, fueled more questions, and made him even more uncertain about what he preferred. The surgeon didn't know what to do with him. In truth, neither type is quite what people desire. We want information and control, but we also want guidance. The Emanuels described a third type of doctor-patient relationship, which they called interpretive. Here, the doctor's role is to help patients determine what they want. Interpretive doctors ask, "What is most important to you? What are your worries?" Then, when they know your answers, they tell you about the red pill and the blue pill and which one would most help you achieve your priorities. Experts have come to call this shared decision-making. It seems to us medical students a nice way to work with patients as physicians, but it seemed almost entirely theoretical. Certainly to the larger medical community, the idea that most doctors would play this kind of role for patients seemed far-fetched at the time. Surgeons? Interpretive? Ha! Huh. I didn't hear clinicians talk about the idea again and largely forgot about it. The choices in training seemed to be between the more paternalistic style and the more informative one. Yet less than 2 decades later, here we were with my father in a neurosurgeon's office in Cleveland, Ohio, talking about MRI images showing a giant and deadly tumor growing in his spinal cord, and this other kind of doctor, one willing to genuinely share decision-making, was precisely what we found. Benzel saw himself as neither the commander nor a mere technician in this battle, but instead as a kind of counselor and contractor on my father's behalf. It was exactly what my father needed. Rereading the paper afterward, I found the author's warning that doctors would sometimes have to go farther than just interpreting people's wishes in order to serve their needs adequately. Wants are fickle, and everyone has what philosophers call second-order desires, desires about our desires. We may wish, for instance, to be less impulsive, more healthy, less controlled by primitive desires like fear or hunger, more faithful to larger goals. Doctors who listen to only the momentary first-order desires may not be serving their patients' real wishes after all. We often appreciate clinicians who push us when we make short-sighted choices, such as skipping our medications or not getting enough exercise. And we often adjust to changes we initially fear. At some point, therefore, it becomes not only right, but also necessary for a doctor to deliberate with people on their larger goals, to even challenge them to rethink ill-considered priorities and beliefs. In my career, I have always been most comfortable being doctor informative. My generation of physicians has mostly steered away from being doctor knows best. But doctor informative was clearly not sufficient to help Sarah Monopoli or the many other seriously ill patients I'd had. Around the time of my father's visits with Benzel, I was asked to see a 72-year-old woman with metastatic ovarian cancer who had come to my hospital's emergency room because of vomiting. Her name was Jewel Douglas, and looking through her medical records, I saw that she'd been in treatment for 2 years. Her first sign of the cancer had been a feeling of abdominal bloating. She saw her gynecologist, who found, with the aid of an ultrasound, a mass in her pelvis the size of a child's fist. In the operating room, it proved to be an ovarian cancer, and it had spread throughout her abdomen. Soft, fungating tumor deposits studded her uterus, her bladder, her colon, and the lining of her abdomen. The surgeon removed both of her ovaries, the whole of her uterus, half of her colon, and a third of her bladder. She underwent 3 months of chemotherapy. With this kind of treatment, most ovarian cancer patients at her stage survive 2 years, and a third survive 5 years. About 20% of patients are actually cured. She hoped to be among these few.